Tonight we have Speaker Tory Lee, who's been very active with this group in the past. He's a member of the Saturday morning men's group at Triangle. One of the first people to really come up to me when I got here and look me in the eye and ask me how I was doing. I really felt like he wanted to know. He just made me feel safe here. I'm so glad that you were here in the beginning for me. Really look forward to you sharing your story tonight. Please welcome Tory Lee.
I'm Troy and I'm an alcoholic. As you can tell by my accents, my story starts in Brooklyn, New York. It's so good to be here at Napa. This is where I got sober. Unfortunately, my schedule takes me to other meetings at other clubhouses, but this is where it's always a special place for me. The sobriety in these rooms are unique and special to anywhere else in Atlanta. And if you're new to this program, this is a great place to be and to get started in AA. So many of the people that I haven't seen over so many years that I came in here, the first thing they asked me, and four, no less, said, "Troy, are you going to tell the truth tonight?" And I told every one of them, "Hell no. I'm going to lie. I'm talking to you, aren't I? When my lips are..." What a stupid question. We're in an AA meeting. I'm going to give you the best I can. Saturday morning, I had just gotten back from overseas and I couldn't sleep. And I went down to the Dunkin' Donuts, and it was about 5 o'clock in the morning. I went in and I got my donuts, and I was walking out, and there was two guys standing in the parking lot. And they looked disheveled, they looked scared, and they were talking amongst themselves. And they were talking about the fact that apparently the night before they had come into town and they had checked in the hotel and that they had immediately gone out and started partying in Atlanta. And they were discussing the fact that they didn't know where they were. They were talking about the fact they didn't know or remember the name of the hotel that they had checked in. And they had already spent all their money. It was 4 o'clock. Somehow they had to get back because they had some sort of meeting to be to at about 8:30. And I was immediately could identify with the fear, with the desperation, with the sense of impending doom that they were going through. And, you know, I'm 3 years sober in this program, and I felt like, gosh, I am so far away from where they are right now. But yet, I'm right there with them. I could be right there tomorrow. And you can stand on a street corner, and you can witness that, and it can make it fresh in your mind where you've been and where you need to be, or you can come in these rooms and you can experience it every day and hear what you need to hear. And these rooms have served me so well. You know, the promises have come true in my life, and everything this program has offered me in the way of promises has happened in my life. 3 years ago when I entered this program, I had a son that wouldn't talk to me. I had a lady who I was very interested in, didn't want any part of me. And I had a family that all but disowned me. And last July, I married that lady. And my son was my best man. And the only people invited to the wedding was my family. And that is a tremendous testament for me to what this program can offer everyone. And that's what I'm going to talk about this evening, is my story. I'm a native Atlanta. I was born at Georgia Baptist Hospital in 1961 in the old wing. I grew up on Stewart Avenue, which is now Metropolitan Parkway, as some of you may from out of town might know it. Early I moved out to Fayette County, and I grew up out there in the countryside in a wonderful childhood with wonderful parents. I've heard so many people's story when they talk about the difficult childhood they have. That's not my story. I was given everything a child could be given. I went to a fine school. Then it was called Georgia Military Academy. It's now Woodward Academy. When I went there, my parents promised me a gun. And for the first 5 years I was there at Georgia Military Academy, I had a broomstick. And the year that I was supposed to be awarded my gun, it turned co-ed, and instead of a gun, we got girls. And normally that would be welcome, but for a 10-year-old, there's not a lot you can do with a girl, but there's a lot you can do with a gun. So that was my first resentment. I grew from there. They got a lot worse from there. But I had a great experience at school. They had a wonderful athletic program there. In the fall I played football. In the winters I wrestled. In the summers and springs I played baseball. Had a great time. I had great coaches. I had a great experience. The only problem I had is in high school, I began to notice or feel different from the other kids. I felt like I was less than. You know, to get to know me was to dislike me, I felt. And for some reason, that continued to grow in me during my high school years. And it made for a very lonely existence. I was always apart from everyone else. Didn't date a lot. I wasn't that popular. You know, the best way not to ever make a mistake is to never do anything. And the best way to people not realize that you're less than who they are is just not to get close to anybody. And that's kind of how that was my policy during high school. And when I finally got the opportunity to graduate and I finally got the opportunity to go to college, that was the one thing that I was going to rectify in my life, is I was going to be popular. And so the day before I went to school, I remember I laid out in the sun all day to try to get some sort of tan to be looking good when I went down there, and I ended up with second-degree burns. And so when I got to school, I had all these water blisters all over my face. I was really, really looking good. And finally got to school, and I got down there, and my parents were there with me, and my mother wanted me to be a preacher. And being the good child I was going to honor her wishes, so I enrolled in the school of theology and was very, very pious about what I was going to do and how hard I was going to work to become a preacher. And when they left, I immediately saw two objectives. I had my first cigarette and I had my first beer. And I remember going to a bar and getting drunk that evening and going into the bathroom, a little bathroom, really wasn't a bathroom, it was a toilet in a room, and standing over that toilet trying to hit it and saying, God, this is what it feels like to be drunk. This feels great. That first night, I developed a love affair with alcohol. I mean, it made me to where I could converse. It made me to where I was felt like I was interesting. It made me to where I felt like I was accepted. It did everything I wanted it to do. And for that day forward, alcohol was in my life pretty much every day. I was so good at drinking that I joined a fraternity, and as soon as they pledged me, they made me the social chairman. And I spent most of my freshman year with a keg either in my room, in my car, or close by. I was in charge of giving at least 3 or 4 parties a week. And I was good at it. I was good at drinking. And I was good at entertaining. And that's about where the time I had my first intervention. Is some of the brothers in the fraternity got together and they said, look, they said, you know, this doesn't look good, how you drink. It's not a pretty picture. You drink to get drunk, obviously, and, you know, you're laying flat out in the middle of the floor of the of the lodge, and people stepping over you and you're throwing up. It just doesn't look good. Now, when people in a social fraternity that drink come and intervene and tell you you're drinking too much, you might have a problem. But that wasn't what I reacted. You know, they just picking on me. And I immediately sought out other people in that fraternity that drank like I did. And that became my modus operandi, was to seek out people that wanted to drink like I wanted to drink. Those are who I wanted to be my friend. Those are who I wanted to be popular with. And that became pretty much the people I sought after for a long time there from then on. I graduated from college. I never became that preacher that my mother wanted me to become, obviously. And with a short stint in law school, I got married to a very fine young lady started working in Atlanta and convinced her that she needed to work evenings. And I worked during the day, and she worked at night, and then I went and partied at night. And she'd get home from working, and sometime 2 or 3 or 4 hours later, I would arrive home. And that did not make for a very successful marriage, obviously. And she finally informed me that I had a lot of social problems, and I obviously probably had a drinking problem, and that she didn't want any more part of me. Now, apparently she was correct, but she later became a professor of psychology at Clemson University. So, although at the time I told her, well, hell, I'm tired of you anyway, so I'm enjoying the life I'm leading out here, running around and finding these fascinating people that I'm meeting in bars, and this is the life I want to lead. And so I was single. And it also developed a pattern that every time I got a divorce, I ended up with just my books and my clothes. And I was on my way. And not long thereafter, again, which was true to my form, I married a drinking buddy of mine. And I thought this would make a perfect fit. You know, we love to drink together. We love to do drugs together. This should make a great marriage. And we got married, and the party started. And we decided that things were so good, let's bring a child into this world. And so we had a son. Turned out to be one of the best things I ever did in my life. You know, my alcohol usage at this point in my life, and this was in my 30s, had become not a choice. It was something I had to do every day. It was about when I was going to use or when I was going to drink every day. It wasn't if. You know, this involves a pool story, which I enjoy sharing, and a lot of people know, is every Saturday morning, for some reason, I'd always find myself short of alcohol. So I would go to this liquor store. It was the liquor store in Kennesaw that opened up earlier than any other liquor store in the city of Kennesaw. And it just so happened to sell pool supplies, too. It was a pool supply and a liquor store. Pool supplies on one side of the building, and the alcohol was on the other. So, being a leading figure in the community, I didn't want people to think that every Saturday morning I needed to buy alcohol, so I wanted to think I was buying pool supplies. So I would go in there and I'd buy my chlorine, and I would buy my pool filters, and then I would buy a gallon of vodka and a gallon of bourbon and a case of Bud Light, and I'd leave. Now, all this would be fine if I'd had a pool. But I did not have a pool. And when we sold that house, about half that garage was full of pool supplies. That's insane thinking, I would think. But that was where we were at as far as our use of alcohol. You know, we recycled, I remember, and the crazy things you do, we recycled because we were so concerned about the environment, and we had to have 4 recycling bins because they were all full of Bud Light cans by the time the recycling man came, and I would clean all the Bud Light cans, wash them all out real neatly, and put newspaper on top of them so the people driving by when I set the cans out couldn't see the Bud Light cans. And there was probably about 2 or 3 cases of beer in those recycling cans. And, you know, the things you do at trying to keep up pretenses, you got that other life going. You're trying to put up that facade, and how much energy and time you put up in that facade when actually you're just crumbling on the inside. And that's where my wife and I were at that point in time. I remember... I was a scoutmaster, and I remember, you know, I couldn't even go to a scout meeting without drinking. And I remember going into a church basement with other scout leaders, and the main scout master there was the chief of police in Kennesaw. And I had to go down there after a night, an entire night, of using cocaine. And I had a big thing of vodka, thermos of it, and I was drinking, and one of the other scout masters found that thermos of vodka, and I was confronted, and I was kicked out of scouts, which was rather embarrassing, and told to leave the church. And you know, the only thing that went on in my mind was, well, damn, they caught me. You know, how ridiculous. I've done so much for this scout troop. I can't believe that they would kick me out for some small infraction like carrying a gallon of vodka in a scout meeting. I finally was told by my father, at this time I was working for my father and grandfather, that I needed to work for my grandfather. And it was like a life sentence. And I went down there because this was probably the meanest white man you'd ever want to meet in your life. His name was Robert E. Lee. And we called him affectionately the General. And for a while after I started working for him, people thought my first name was Dammit. Dammit Troy. He was, you know, the result of untreated alcoholism. No question about it. No one wanted to be around this man. I tell you a story about him. One time a friend of his sold him some lumber, and he felt like the guy had overcharged him, and the guy wouldn't negotiate any on the bill. So my grandfather had me go to the bank and order the difference in pennies. And this was like $1,000 difference. And I don't know if you've ever carried around $1,000 worth of pennies, but it's heavy. And it took about 3 of us. And we went in the guy's place of business and dumped those pennies on his counter and said, "This is Mr. Lee. This is how he wants to settle up the bill with you." That was the kind of crazy things that I was a part of. That was the kind of insanity that was in my life. And that's what I accepted as normal. You know, working for him was tough, and I was drinking a great deal. I was coming home, and after consuming at least, you know, a pint of bourbon in the car and several beers, talking in the house and smoking a joint and sitting on the back porch every night. And that does not foster a good parental relationship with a child, and doesn't foster a great relationship with a wife. But that's what I did every day. And the weekends, you know, I was fine as long as no one wanted to disturb me, because all I wanted to do all weekend long was sit on that back porch and drink or smoke pot. You know, I finally came convinced of the craziness that was existing in my life, and I decided that the only way that I could possibly quit drinking is if my wife stopped drinking. So I sent her to rehab. And she came back, and when she came back cured. She went down to Talbot for 2 months, and she came back, and I decided God, I don't want to be around this person. This is really going to cramp my drinking. So I moved out and began a process where we tried to reconcile by going to therapy, and I had no intention of trying to reconcile. I was already out of there. I moved out again with my books and my clothes, and I moved into a hotel and was able to sink completely into drinking as much as I wanted to, using as much as I wanted to, and a downward spiral happened fast. Fast forward it, I met a woman that meant a lot to me, and she said, you know, I can't be around you anymore. You know, you are a disaster. And the best thing that I could think of was, is, you know, you're right, and I think I'm an alcoholic, and I'll see what I can do to deal with it. I'll join AA. I'll make a commitment to you. I will go to one AA meeting a week. I will go to a psychiatrist once a week, and I'll go to church. And I think I can whip this thing. And so I began. First meeting I ever went to was over here at the Biscayne Room. I planned going over there very carefully because I felt like I had to, you know, people were going to really wonder why I was walking in there. So I dressed accordingly, just in case I didn't like how things were going. I was going to tell them that, you know, I was writing a report and that I was here to observe. I got in there and I sat down and started listening to the sharing, and I could immediately identify what these people were talking about. And I really felt something I hadn't felt in a long time without a drink. I felt acceptance. And it really impressed me. I started crying. And at this particular meeting, it was on Tuesday nights, and everyone shared. And the meeting wasn't over until everyone shared. And there was a lady there by the name of Cindy Tracy. And, you know, every once in a while, you're able to meet one of these grand dames of AA that bring these steps to light. And she was just one of those people, just one of those incredible people that you meet every once in a while in this program, that have it, that eyes are just lit up with this program, and they have everything that you could ever want to have. And she's just one of those people. And I was crying in that meeting, and they asked me if I wanted to share, and I said yes, and I just told them how scared I was of where my life was. I was scared because I didn't know how to quit drinking. I knew I had to. I was scared because I felt like I was losing everything that I had that was important in my life. That's what drinking does. That's what alcohol does. That's what drugs do. They take and they take and they take from you everything that you have until they finally take what's the most important thing you have, and then it leaves you. It no longer does you any good. It no longer does what it was supposed to do. It just leaves you. And it hadn't gotten to that point yet, but it was pretty close for me at that point in time. And I remember she looked at me, Cindy Tracy, at the end of that meeting, and she said, and I'll never forget it, because it made an impression on me the rest of, well, from then on to now. She said, we have lived all your nightmares here, and we have felt all your pain. And one day, through this very simple program, you can enjoy all our hope and feel all our joy. And that just really resonated in me. And I went to going from the promise of one meeting a week to where I was in there every day. I just wanted to know what these people had. There was some type of yearning in me that wanted to be a part of it. And it wasn't because of the program. I didn't know anything about steps. It was because of the people that were in the program. And I wanted, by their example, what they had. I started meeting more people in the program. I met a young man who was a trainer. and he is a member here, a gentleman by the name of Wes, and he's still my trainer. And every day we work out together, or every about three times a week, and we talk program. And I met him, and at that time I think he was 27 years old, and he was part of this program, and I was sharing with him that I had just started going with Biscayne, and he got me set up with a sponsor. And he's still my sponsor today. And he's been through some hard times with me. He was probably the strongest example I had in this program of how I wanted to live my life in sobriety. And that's why I can't emphasize sponsorship enough, is that is a person will bring these steps to life for you and will introduce you to the rest of the herd and make you feel more part of this program. And that's what happened to me with my sponsor. So everything was going along real well for me. I was in this program. I was going every day. I remember driving in my driveway one day saying, God Almighty, I have been sober for 3 weeks, and I've never thought about drinking. It came so easy for me. I felt accepted. I felt a group of people that I could identify with. They liked me. They wanted to be around me. And God Almighty, I loved it. I started taking it for granted. You know, I really at that point in time didn't have a respect for this disease that I should have had. I really didn't know how cunning and baffling it was. I didn't know how deadly it was. I didn't know how serious it was. And sobriety came so easy for me. And I got to where I started letting my own thinking run away with me. I remember I was out of town. I came down from being dressed, sat down in the bar across from someone I knew. She said, how about a glass of wine? I said, I think I will. And, you know, it just, and I felt like, well, you know, I've got this thing so down. Next week I'll really bear down on this program hard. And, you know, I think I can do it, you know, sober during the week, drink during the weekend. I think I've got a new style. And, you know, I tried it. And, you know, I think my problem is alcohol. I don't think the cocaine's that big of a problem. I think if I eliminate the alcohol, I think I can work this other stuff out. And I tried it. And as you can imagine, the result was disastrous. And that downward spiral, you know, it just... The alcohol and the drugs took me places I didn't want to be, and it brought me around people that I didn't want to be around, and they started scaring me more and more and more and more. But I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. And one day, my grandfather, who had died, and incidentally, I had to bury him because there was nobody else in my family really wanted to be a part of it. I had to go out and buy him a suit, dress him, and I really can't blame a lot of the people in my family. And I think that's what untreated alcoholism will do. It'll drive everyone out of your life. But that's another story. So we, in the company, had a book written on the business that we're in. And we dedicated it to my grandfather, which is very important for me to do, is to dedicate this book to my grandfather. So the day that the book was supposed to be presented to the industry, the night before, I decided I'd have a drink. Well, at that point in time, a drink, I had no idea after I took that drink where I was going to end up. Maybe it'd be okay. Maybe it wouldn't. Maybe I'd end up out on the street somewhere without a dollar in my pocket, not knowing where I was, just like those boys coming out of Dunkin' Donuts. It happened to me a lot. And this evening, I took a drink, and I ended up in a hotel room, not able to walk, not able to talk, having to drink about a bottle of vodka just to where I could form words. And you know, at the most inappropriate times. And people were down there at that trade mart in Dallas for that book, who was dedicated to my grandfather, to release it to the industry, and Troy wasn't there, and Troy couldn't be found. I eventually was able to get sober enough to get on the plane and get the hell out of there. Well, needless to say, that brought a lot of questions from a lot of people. And still didn't think, you know, I just got caught. But that same woman that meant so much to me put her foot down and said, "That's it." And again, I said, "Well, let me try. Let me try to whip this problem." So I was earnest this time. I was scared. So I went to Betty Ford, and they did a tremendous thing for me out there. They said, "Son, first thing you got to do is you got to quit smoking. You got to change how you work. You got to change how you live. You got to change everything about you." And I took their suggestions, and I stopped smoking. And I changed how I was living. And during that time, my son came out there for family weekend, and they sat me down in front of him, and my son started telling me how he felt that his life had been impaired because of my drinking and my using. And he started telling me about this person that I had no idea who he was. And I was in complete denial. I was mad. I was angry. How dare you talk about your father when all I've done for you is live my life for you? Bullshit. I didn't live my life for him. I lived my life for me and getting high and drinking when I wanted to. He was an inconvenience a lot of his life. And he told me things that I just couldn't buy, but it was like somebody taking a 2x4 and just beat me with it when he talked to me. I got out of Betty Ford, and I came to Atlanta, and I knew I needed continued help. So I camped my ass out on Ridgeview Steps until that they would take me into the professionals program. And went over there for 2 days, from 7 in the morning, and waited for this woman to talk to me. And finally she talked to me, and she let me in that program. And so I was there for about 6 weeks. And I got out of there. And my sponsor took me back after I'd lied to him, deceived him. He showed me what this program was about again. And we began to work again on these steps. And it was a lot different this time. This time I took every suggestion that was given to me. This time I did everything in earnest. You know, a while back in January, I was about 50 pounds overweight. And the doctor put me on a diet. And about 5 weeks later, I came back into him and I weighed more. And I said, "You know, I've tried, I've done it. By God, I've done it. This damn thing just doesn't work." And I told you it wouldn't work, and it doesn't work. He said, "Well, tell me what you've been doing, Troy." And I told him what I'd been doing, how I'd followed this damn diet of his. And he said, "You know, by what you've told me that you've been doing, it bears no resemblance to what I asked you to do." And that's exactly how I worked this program before. By God, I worked it, but it was my own arrangement. And this time, I was working it according to the suggestions I was given and following the steps as they are written, not as I chose to make them up. And it started happening for me. You know, I don't think anybody comes in here working steps 1, 2, and 3. They come in here because they have a drinking problem. I did. I came in here because I had a drinking problem. I wanted to stop. But the longer I was in here, I started seeing the insanity in my life. I started seeing the powerlessness I had over alcohol. What tripped me up was, how do you turn your will and your life over to a higher power? And it was explained to me that the higher power needed to be this program. I didn't need to be thinking any higher than that. The higher power is this program, the people in this program, and to follow the direction as given by this program. And that worked. That worked real well. And in time and following these suggestions, I started developing a relationship with the higher power. By turning it over to someone else, I started learning about some of my own deficits in personality in my life. I started learning how to live with who I actually was for the first time in my life, accepting who I was with all my faults. And that's when I started making a lot of progress, because I started learning about humility. You know, I'm an alcoholic and I'm an addict first. This program then taught me about how to be a son to my parents. It taught me how to be a husband to a wife. It taught me how to be a father to my son. And it taught me about humility. And part of humility was, it taught me that for my son, in order to have a relationship with him, I had to turn him over to a therapist. And the only way I could talk to my son was through a therapist. And I did that for about a year and a half. And I went down there and I took that therapist's suggestions. And I listened to what that therapist had to tell me. And that's how I had to deal with my son. And after 3 years of listening to somebody else and making amends with him, I started developing a relationship with him. And that's the story of how I've come through this program. Is I found the examples in these rooms that I wanted to mirror my life by, and seeing how they work the steps in this program and following suit. But if I hadn't been here in these rooms, it wasn't going to happen. A man from St. Simon's, Bob Prednick, says, "God with skin is in these rooms. And the only way you're going to witness it is to be here. And you're not going to witness it if you're not here." And that has resounded in me, the truth in that. That's what brings me in here. Not every meeting is as interesting as another, and not what everyone has to say is something that I need to hear. But if I'm not here, I'm going to miss that one statement that's going to make a difference. And that's God speaking to me. And I'm only going to witness it if I'm here. You know, today I practice coming to meetings, because I love to come to them. I practice talking with my sponsor on a daily basis. I practice the steps. And I practice the steps in kind of an unusual way. I practice the steps because I come to meetings and I talk to other alcoholics, and I feel like if you do that, you do that enough, you do work the steps. I practice sponsorship. I have wonderful gentleman I work with, and that has been very rewarding to me. And I practice continuing to develop a relationship with a higher power through prayer. And I've learned how to pray because of my sponsor. And I practice that daily. To me, I have to be in a meeting every day, with the exception of Friday, and I devote that day to the wife I have now, for us to go out. I still go to groups at Ridgeview. I still go to a psychiatrist once a week. I have a very full schedule in recovery, and I don't see that changing, because that's what I need. This program has done so much for me in my life. And the main thing I think it's given me is a place to come and feel accepted, and people to share my life with, people that are worthy. You know, there's so many icons in these rooms that can lead you in the right direction. And I need that leadership and that help. And I found them in these rooms, and as I said, this is one of the best places to find them at Napa. And you're lucky you're here. And I appreciate your time, and I've really enjoyed this. And good night, and God bless you.
Well,
said. Thank you, Troy.